It's Monday, March 30th. Today, the Fed is staring down a potential nightmare as the jobs report looms and gas prices threaten to blow a hole in the economy. We're also looking at the GOP's growing civil war over IVF, and the reason your natural accent always comes back after a few drinks. Following up on the tension we've been tracking in the Middle East, analysts are increasingly wargaming what a direct escalation with Iran would actually look like for the global economy. Here is the news you need to know. Look, the Federal Reserve is currently staring down what might be the worst-case scenario for the stock market. This week is dominated by the upcoming March jobs report, and the stakes are high. If that report comes back weak, it puts the Fed in a brutal position where they might have to consider tightening monetary policy, meaning raising interest rates, even while the labor market is softening. Right now, the market is actually starting to price in a potential rate hike for 2026. That tells you investors are genuinely worried the Fed will be forced to squeeze the economy further just to keep a lid on things, which is basically poison for equities. We've seen layoff data stabilize for the moment, but there's a massive wild card here: gasoline prices. If the regional tension keeps pushing fuel costs up, it's going to gut consumer spending and eventually kill off hiring. In this environment, every single inflation report is a live grenade. Speaking of consumer spending, keep an eye on Nike. They've got a critical earnings report coming up that's going to serve as a bellwether for the whole sector. Analysts are split down the middle on this one. Half of them think Nike is about to show improving margins and a comeback in China, which would be a huge buy signal for companies like Starbucks and Estee Lauder. The other half thinks Nike is just stalling out, that they've lost control of their costs and their growth has hit a wall. How Nike talks about demand in China is going to set the tone for every other consumer-facing brand on the board. While the Fed watches jobs, geopolitical analysts are sketching out the what-if scenarios for a broader conflict. One specific concern being discussed is how a strike on Iranian oil export hubs would paralyze the market. Russia isn't helping either, having decided to ban its own gasoline exports to tighten global supply. One technical analyst noted that if West Texas Intermediate crude stays above $102.25, we're likely headed for a spike into the 111 to 124 range. If it drops below $85, we might see a reversal, but right now, the geopolitical math is pointing straight up. Now, if you're looking for a place to hide from all that volatility, the conversation around digital assets is shifting from speculative gamble to monetary insurance. The argument being made by people like Wall Street veteran Omid Malik is that Bitcoin isn't just digital gold, it's actually better than gold because you can actually move it. Gold is heavy, hard to store, and a pain to transact with. Bitcoin's plumbing allows for rapid global transfers via private keys, which makes it a resilient form of financial infrastructure when things go sideways. As the world looks at de-dollarization, countries trying to rely less on the US dollar, Bitcoin is standing there as a decentralized alternative. It's not just about Bitcoin, though. Institutional investors are starting to look at the broader blockchain ecosystem using the same metrics they use for tech stocks: user growth, revenue, and addressable markets. We're seeing areas like decentralized finance, DeFi, and the intersection of AI and blockchain being treated as legitimate growth sectors. Here's the thing: holding zero digital assets is starting to be viewed as a strategic risk. Coinbase was added to the S&P 500 last year, which means digital assets are now part of the benchmarks that professional fund managers are measured against. There's also a massive generational divide. Younger investors are choosing Bitcoin over gold by a wide margin. When you look at the market caps, Bitcoin at $2 trillion versus gold at $35 trillion, there is a hell of a lot of room for that gap to close as that generational shift plays out. If the future of finance is digital and integrated with AI, being underallocated here might look like a massive unforced error in a few years. Back home, the anti-abortion movement is fracturing in a way that's creating a massive headache for the GOP. Ever since Roe v. Wade was overturned, a more extreme, abolitionist wing has emerged. These groups are frustrated because abortion rates haven't actually dropped as much as they expected. so they're pushing for laws that would criminalize the patients themselves, even bringing up the death penalty. This is a political nightmare for Republicans. They need these activists to win primaries, but the policies are radioactive with the general public. We see this playing out with medication abortion. Senator Josh Hawley has a bill to strip FDA approval for mifepristone. It probably won't pass, but it's a clear signal. The movement is targeting the mail-order services that allow people in restrictive states to still access care. They're trying to frame this as protecting women from medical providers, which, honestly, flies in the face of the scientific consensus on how safe these drugs actually are. And it's not stopping at abortion. The movement is now coming for in vitro fertilization, IVF. There's a push for something called restorative reproductive medicine, which is basically a conservative alternative that tries to fix infertility without using IVF. This creates a huge ideological mess. If you argue that an embryo is a person, then the standard IVF process, which often involves discarding unused embryos, becomes a problem. Republicans are caught between this logic and the fact that plenty of conservative families have used IVF to have kids. It's a collision between deep-seated ideology and the reality of how people actually live their lives. On the foreign policy front, Representative Yasemin Ansari is raising alarms about the prospect of a direct conflict with Iran. She's the only Iranian-American Democrat in Congress, and she's arguing that any move toward war would be wildly illegal, without congressional authorization. Her concern is that the U.S. is drifting toward a confrontation where there is no off-ramp. Ansari is pointing to the potential human cost, warning that a full-scale war could lead to thousands of civilian casualties and displacement on a scale that would dwarf previous regional conflicts. Her own constituents in Arizona are over it. 74% of them are polled as being against military intervention. She's worried that by blowing things up without a plan, we're just going to leave the Iranian people stuck with an even more hardline, radical regime than the one they have now. It's the same old story of unintended consequences, just with higher stakes. While Ansari is pushing for restraint, a specific slice of the Iranian-American diaspora is doing the exact opposite. They're actually rallying behind the idea of military escalation. Their goal is simple. They want the Islamic Republic to fall, and they're willing to back a war to make it happen. You'll see them at protests waving the old lion and sun flag from before 1979, often alongside American and Israeli flags. It looks like a strange alliance, but it's a the enemy of my enemy is my friend situation. They see Israel as a tool to undermine the current Iranian government. A lot of this is driven by a deep nostalgia for pre-revolutionary Iran, a version of the country that looks a lot better in old photos than the current reality. They've rallied around Reza Pahlavi, the son of the last Shah. Most people don't necessarily see him as a permanent king, but he's a focal point for the opposition. Just keep in mind, this isn't the whole diaspora. There are plenty of Iranian Americans who think a war would be a disaster, and that the U.S. is only involved for its own selfish interests, not out of any love for the Iranian people. Finally, let's talk about something more personal. The way you talk. It turns out your accent is basically a love letter to your life, even if you've spent years trying to hide it. American accents actually started as a leveling of different British dialects. By the late 1700s, we had the New England twang and the distinct Southern drawl, which was heavily influenced by cultural shifts after the Civil War. The interesting part is how we use accents to navigate the world. People often try to scrub their accents to sound more marketable or professional. It's a form of linguistic assimilation that can be pretty painful. But research shows that your original accent usually wins in the end. It'll come back when you're tired, when you've had a drink, or when you're talking to people from home. Reclaiming an accent is becoming a way for people to reject the pressure to conform. It's not about prestige anymore. It's about representing your actual lived experience. If you feel connected to where you came from, you're more likely to keep the local speech patterns. It's a reminder that trying to sound like everyone else is usually a losing game anyway. So while we're busy worrying about how we sound, the people over at Goldman Sachs are more worried about how their code sounds, specifically, how much money it's making them. The era of AI experimentation is officially over, at least according to Goldman Sachs. The bank's chief information officer, Marco Argenti, says the technology has matured into a reliable tool for daily, mission-critical operations. Goldman is now moving past vague talk of productivity and demanding a rigorous evaluation of return on investment. The bank is putting its money where its mouth is through its GS AI assistant and developer tools like Cloud Code. These tools are reportedly accelerating project timelines, but notably, they aren't leading to layoffs for developers. Instead, the firm says there's such a massive backlog of unaddressed business initiatives that they still need the bodies. They just need them to do different work. The role of the developer is shifting from pure coding to something more like a product manager, emphasizing ideation, delegation, and the supervision of AI output. There's a bit of a build versus buy revolution happening here too. Goldman is actively replacing third-party software vendors with internally built AI solutions because the cost and time to build applications have dropped so dramatically. If you're a software vendor whose product isn't easily adaptable to AI agents, the bank essentially views you as obsolete. It's a cold-blooded move, but Goldman is prioritizing velocity over simple speed, embedding these capabilities into their core platform while keeping a tight grip on regulatory compliance. While the veterans at Goldman are safe for now, the outlook for new graduates is significantly more grim. Big Tech is currently hiring new grads at a fraction of pre-pandemic rates. The reason? AI has become proficient at the exact tasks traditionally handed to junior employees: basic writing, entry-level coding, and data analysis. Employment for 22 to 25-year-olds in AI-exposed fields has fallen, while the roles for experienced professionals remain stable. To get hired now, a degree isn't enough. The report suggests graduates have to demonstrate AI literacy, showing exactly how they use large language models for specific tasks like brand management or budget optimization. The entry-level job of the future isn't doing the work, it's validating the AI's work. If you want a job that AI can't touch, you might have to look at unsexy industries. Senior healthcare is seeing a massive investment boom because of an undeniable demographic shift. The population over 85 is expected to double by 2040. These individuals spend an average of $22,000 annually on healthcare, and AI can't physically help someone out of bed or provide home-based care. While tech workers are fighting over AI prompts, the labor market for home health aides is projected to explode. On the consumer side, we're seeing the rise of specialized AI agents through emerging automation platforms. This isn't a general chatbot. It's a system where you deploy multiple distinct agents for specific roles, like Polly for personal assistance or Sam for sales. Claire Vaux, a prominent advocate for these systems, argues that assigning all tasks to one AI leads to frustration. The move here is toward a personal AI ecosystem where you manage your agents like you're onboarding a human assistant. The security advice for this, however, is a bit of a reality check. Experts suggest running these agents on a dedicated clean machine, like an old Mac Mini, rather than your primary computer. You don't want a rogue agent accidentally deleting your hard drive or executing a malicious instruction because you gave it too much access too fast. Finally, things are getting weird in the gig economy. There's a growing conversation around AI-to-human marketplaces where AI agents literally hire humans to perform physical tasks. It's a marketplace where the AI is the employer and the human is the physical labor. While some of the current branding for these concepts is leaning into doom-baiting and marketing stunts, it points to a future where AI handles the digital strategy and humans are just the physical intermediaries. We're seeing a similar foraging behavior in corporate marketing. KFC recently released a pickle-stuffed puffer jacket, not because their creative team has stroke of genius, but because they found an AI-generated concept that was already trending and simply made it real. They didn't invent the trend, they foraged for it. Even the government is catching on to the side effects of these new technologies. Prediction markets like Polymarket and Kalshi have become accidental corruption detectors. By allowing people to bet on outcomes, they've made insider trading and non-public information so blatant that Congress is now pushing bipartisan bills to ban the practice. It turns out that when you put a public price tag on a secret, it's a lot harder for politicians and executives to keep that secret hidden. Speaking of prediction markets and federal bans, it's not just political secrets they're worried about. It's the point spread. Look, the intersection of sports betting and the broader economy is getting messy, and Washington is finally trying to draw a line in the sand. Bipartisan legislation is currently moving through Congress to ban sports betting on prediction markets. According to recent reports, the goal here is to create a hard boundary between legitimate financial instruments and straight-up gambling. Right now, the lines between trading options, using prediction markets, and betting on a parlay are getting incredibly blurry. Lawmakers are worried that if they don't step in, these markets, which are supposed to be tools for economic forecasting, just become another venue for addiction and financial ruin. There's some real irony here. While they're looking at sports, they're also starting to eye zero-day options trading, which some argue is basically gambling with a Bloomberg terminal. It's funny how we're okay with high-stakes speculation as long as it's tied to a corporate balance sheet, but the second it's tied to a point spread, it's a national crisis. Speaking of things getting messy, the private credit market is ballooning, and sports is a huge part of where that money is flowing. But there's a massive asset-liability mismatch brewing. Kieran Goodwin recently pointed out that these private credit funds are promising investors liquidity they might not actually have. They're making loans to companies, including those in the sports and software sectors, based on annual recurring revenue rather than actual profit. If the economy dips and everyone wants their money back at once, these funds only allow about 5% of redemptions per quarter. That creates a feedback loop where managers are forced to sell assets into a falling market. We're essentially watching a massive experiment in shadow banking, where the valuations are opaque and the risks are being offloaded to retail investors. It's the kind of thing that looks brilliant until the first time the music stops and there aren't enough chairs for the 1%. On the brand side, the strategy is shifting from broad sponsorships to what's being called cultural fluency. The National Lottery is the blueprint here. They've moved away from just slapping a logo on a stadium and are instead embedding themselves into specific fandoms. For example, they've tied their purpose messaging to the Lionesses, the England women's national football team, by specifically funding grassroots girls' football. According to data from the UK, 66% of fans say that brand support actually validates their fandom. It makes them feel like their interest is legitimate. It's a smart, if slightly cynical, play. You aren't just buying an ad, you're buying a seat at the table of someone's identity. The National Lottery even uses an in-house agency, Studio 59, to react to cultural moments in real time. Which, honestly, is the only way to reach anyone under the age of 40 these days. If you aren't part of the conversation, you're just background noise. And in an economy where the bottom 90% of people feel like the system is rigged against them, brands are realizing they have to provide some kind of cultural resonance or good vibes just to get someone to open their wallet. It's not about the game anymore. It's about making the consumer feel like they're part of something that isn't totally shitty. Of course, if the world feels rigged and the markets are a mess, you might as well work on the one thing you can actually control: your own brain. Neuroplasticity and epigenetics, the study of how your environment and behavior change your gene expression, now support the idea that well-being is a trainable skill, not a fixed personality trait. According to research on the Healthy Minds framework, flourishing is built on four specific pillars: awareness, connection, insight, and purpose. The data shows that loneliness is a major risk factor for mortality, making social connection a biological necessity rather than a lifestyle choice. To build these skills, researchers are pushing micro-practices, which are integrated exercises as short as 5 minutes a day, designed to physically alter brain structure over time. Look, the idea that you can train yourself to be happy sounds like something out of a mid-level HR seminar. But the science of epigenetics is actually pretty wild. It means we aren't just stuck with the brain we were born with. It turns out that reframing a mundane task as a service to others isn't just a coping mechanism, it's a way to actually rewire your internal state. Meanwhile, a report on motivation suggests that our beliefs, not facts, are the primary drivers of success. The report outlines a motivation triangle consisting of behavior, benefit, and belief. It posits that limiting beliefs act as self-imposed ceilings that we reinforce through confirmation bias. To break this, the report suggests a turnaround process, questioning if a belief is absolutely true, and then examining who you would be without it. For example, Amazon's day one mantra is factually false, but it's used as a functional tool to maintain a startup culture. Finally, there is a growing crisis of meaning linked to how technology engages the left brain. Experts argue that digital tools are great for complicated problem solving, but terrible for complex thinking, the kind of reflection required for coherence and significance. The recommendation here is blunt: tech-free zones in the bedroom and tech fasts to force the brain back into a state where it can actually process why questions instead of just how-to tasks. It's a bit of a shitty paradox. The tools we use to get more done are the exact things making us feel like none of it actually matters. Anyway, while you're pondering the meaning of life, here's a quick list of things that actually matter for your week. All right, a few other things worth knowing before you head out. First, if you're trying to teach your kids about money, stop with the spreadsheets. New data shows that financial body language, basically just letting your teens see you handle real-life stress or even own up to a shitty spending mistake, actually sticks better than a lecture. It turns out being a flawed human is more educational than pretending you're a mid-tier CPA. On the science side, it looks like sexual orientation is less about discovery and more about what happened before you were even born. Research into prenatal testosterone exposure suggests that hormone levels in the womb subtly sculpt adult attraction, leaving physical markers behind in everything from finger-length ratios to the way your inner ear echoes. It's a pretty definitive blow to the lifestyle choice crowd, not that they were big on data anyway. If you're still grinding away at fantasy football, the move for game week 33 is to stop looking at tomorrow and start looking at next month. The play is to burn your wild card now so you can set up a bench boost for the fixture swings in week 37. It's a lot of math for a game that usually ends in heartbreak, but hey, that's the hobby. And finally, if you're thinking about leasing a car with the plan to buy it later, don't. You're essentially paying for the depreciation on a long-term rental, and when you finally decide to buy it, you've paid way more in interest and fees than if you just finance the thing from day one. It's a classic expensive way to feel poor trap. Anyway, that's the short list. I'll see you tomorrow. Watch the price of oil, and don't believe everything your brain tells you. Talk soon.